It is Friday, April 13th, 2018. My name is Daniel Bader, and this is the Android Central Podcast. Welcome. I would like to welcome back to the show, Andrew Martinick. How are you? How was your week off from the show?
I am doing just fine, and the week off from the show was, I don't know, it was just like a regular week.
You came to my country.
Yes, briefly.
You sipped the fine wines and you ate the fine cheeses, I assume. You drank the fine maple syrup?
Yeah, I was going to say it's more like beer and maple syrup and baked goods, but you know, hey.
Speaking of fine baked goods,
I'm baked.
He is a cookie. He is a delicious croissant, Jerry Hildenbrand.
The croissant. I kind of like that. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so great. It's Friday. It's disgusting outside, and yes. I'm in here with you, so I'm happy. Let's talk Android. Let's talk Google. Let's talk Samsung. So we're going to do some follow-up from last week. Talk a little bit about this battery brouhaha.
Ooh,
finish
like
that off, because that was a doozy. We finally got a response from Samsung. We're also going to talk about this new Android TV dongle thingy that passed through the FCC earlier this week. Seems interesting. Seems topical. And was there a scandal with OEMs not actually including all the security patches with its quarterly or monthly updates? There's more to the story than meets the eye. Or actually, there's less to the story than meets the eye. Jerry will explain. And then we're going to talk phones. Sony Xperia XZ2 Compact, that's out for pre-order today in the US. Well, also the Xperia Z2, but XZ2, but nobody has that yet. And the LG G7. Andrew's going to explain why it's a make or break moment for the Korean company.
Thank you.
And then finally, there's a new Gmail coming, which is fun because we've been waiting for an update for like 10 years. Can't believe Gmail's been around for 14 years already. That's insane. So we're going to talk about that and what else is new. So we'll start with Samsung. Jerry, you were here last week. You talked about what is going on with the Exynos version of the Samsung Galaxy S9, battery problems, the processor is too powerful for its own good, software can't keep up, blah, blah, blah.
Something like that, yeah.
That's, we have a response now. Samsung says, well, this is a fluffy piece if I've ever heard one. Samsung, the Galaxy S9 is a reimagined smartphone designed to provide the best experience possible. Battery discharge time is dependent upon each user's specific installed apps and settings, as well as other environmental factors. Both processors go through strict and rigorous testing considering real-life usage scenarios in order to provide the same top-of-the-line experience regardless of processor. Samsung is committed to delivering consistent battery performance over the life cycle of the phone to provide users with an optimal experience. What exactly is that?
All it's missing is some theme music.
That was nothing.
Well, it's cover your butt. Then that's what all these companies have to do first.
So let's ask the only real interesting question here. We know that Samsung has a problem with the Exynos chip. We know that it is fixable through software. Would it have done them any good to acknowledge that and actually say, we are going to update it through firmware and fix the problem at a later date? Or is it better for them to just basically ignore it and then give themselves an out? They either fix it or they don't, and they just let this problem go away.
Since we saw what they had to say, I was thinking basically along those lines. That's the smart move. If they admit that there's a problem, even if they say it's easy to fix and we're going to have it fixed very shortly, people that normally wouldn't know or care about something like this, all of a sudden know Samsung says there's a problem with that phone.
Yeah, they can't do that, especially when you don't have any situations in which people are actually cross-shopping the two models with the two different processors. So, you know, each area has, you know, either the Snapdragon or the Exynos. So for most people, it doesn't really matter anyway. It's not like you're going to go through the trouble of importing a gray market Snapdragon device anyway. It's just not something that they would need to address. They're better off. I mean, I would be surprised if they didn't release an update at, you know, or include in the next major update something that could hopefully help a little bit. But pre-announcing that only gets them into trouble if it doesn't live up to those expectations.
So then we're kind of at an impasse here, right? The phones are not, it's not like they're not selling well. And I don't think this issue has really reached the mainstream yet. It's certainly not anywhere close to where the Galaxy Note 7 was. So is Samsung just getting off scot-free here? Or is this even a problem? Is this a problem for just nerds like us who care about these things?
That hits the nail on the head, I think. It's a matter of, what, like 9 hours of battery life while you're working it super, super hard instead of 10? Well, if you sit on your phone nonstop and you're browsing the web for 9 hours, you expect your phone to be charged.
Yeah, I think that the bigger thing is that the Galaxy S9 and S9 Plus just generally, they just have kind of okay battery life. It's not one of their pillars of their experience. And, you know, that's just what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, I'm getting pretty terrible battery life from my S9. That's Snapdragon. I install the same apps I do on every other phone, and I'm at 30, you know, I get to 30% by like 1 p.m. It's pretty sad.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, the S9 Plus is, you know, the Snapdragon version that I have is, it's a full day, but you don't have any wiggle room, which is, you know, that's what I found from my review. The problem is that it's just the core Samsung problem of it's doing a lot of stuff. It has a bright, beautiful display, and it has a lot of different things going on. And whether you're using it or not, you know, actively, you know, Jerry talked about the, you know, using it for 9 hours straight or 10 hours straight. Well, Samsung phones typically have this thing where they just kind of drain at the same rate no matter what you're doing. So it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference. Samsung just, they understand what their big features are, and they didn't make any huge claims about battery life this time around.
So there's one interesting thing here that occurred to me before the show today. The two most popular smartphone companies in the world, Apple and Samsung, sell in excess of 70% of the flagships of the $700-$800 plus phones in the entire world. Those two companies are some of the worst when it comes to battery life. Like,
yeah,
you buy an iPhone 10, your battery's not lasting all day anyway. Unless you buy an iPhone 8 plus, you're not getting great battery life. So,
nope.
And it's the same with Samsung, whereas companies like Huawei, LG, Sony, they kill on battery life. They do great. I mean, the BlackBerry Key 1, the one in your hand, Jerry, that gets 2 days of battery life. It's not difficult to get there.
Well, it's a mixture of two things. Look which phones are the thinnest and the prettiest, too. The iPhone 8, not the 8 Plus, and the iPhone 10 or the S9 and S9 Plus, kind of. They're very thin. They're very, you know, they're very light. I hate to use the word elegant when I'm talking about a phone, but they have been, there was more time spent in design there than most other companies will spend. They assume that we want these very thin, very light devices. That means you can't put a huge battery in it. Now look at what Huawei does. You know, more milliamp hours gives you a whole lot better battery life.
Absolutely. You're right. And I'll push back a little bit there because I picked up my Huawei P20 Pro this week. And that's elegant. That's really elegant. And it's thin. It's not waif thin, but neither is the S9. I mean, Andrew, the S9 and S9 Plus are a couple of millimeters thicker than or a millimeter thicker than last year's models without any battery increase.
Yeah, they're in the low 8 millimeter thickness range.
That's
right?
For the camera.
Dual cameras, yeah.
You know, it's. I mean, this is an argument that we've heard.
Yeah.
For years,
but
right?
I think going back to your original statement there, Daniel, the important thing to note there is the phones that are selling the best do it despite not having amazing battery life. It clearly has not been a major factor hurting Apple and Samsung sales.
But that's the most common complaint we hear from consumers. They want
exactly
better
people
battery
complain
life.
About it, and then they go and continue to buy the phones that have bad battery life. So it obviously doesn't matter that much.
And this goes way back. I mean, I remember the first Sony phone that was any good. I got the compact version. I think it was the Z1 or X1 or something. God, so many phones. It was thick. It was chunky looking. And the battery on it was amazing. But everybody with a Galaxy S, whatever version came out at that time, had a thinner phone that looked arguably better and complained about the battery. So this has gone on forever.
Well, absolutely. It's not a new thing. It's also interesting, Jerry. I mentioned the iPhone, and I know how much our listeners love me talking about the iPhone on the show. But I think this in particular is relevant with iOS 11.3. Apple gives users of the I believe iPhone 6, 6S, 7, and iPhone 6, 6S, and 7 the opportunity to see the state of their battery health. Right?
Yeah.
So there was this controversy last year where iPhones were shutting down. Apple was found to be slowing down phones to prevent them from shutting down due to cold weather. Now with 11.3, you can choose between the two. You can either keep your phone running at full speed but risk shutdown in temperature changes, or you can allow your phone to throttle and continue using it and extend the battery life. Is that something you'd like to see on, say, a Samsung phone?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be the first one to say I think Apple did a fine job with that, other than their public relations response when people started realizing it. It's a good safety issue. It's a good user experience issue. Let it run a little bit slower that most people won't notice instead of just randomly shutting off. That's a good thing. The choice is good, too. I like to see a choice. I'm very surprised that we saw that from Apple. But then I have to remember this isn't the old Apple. So, you know, and now I'm done talking about Apple. But I don't know of any cases where anybody has exactly seen proof that any Android phones have the same issues. Wouldn't surprise me if they're out there. But if you needed that on your phone, if you needed to throttle your phone down to extend its use for the day, and not just, you know, battery saving mode, but, you know, in a special case like what happened with the iPhones or what looks like it's happening with the Exynos S9, yeah, put that choice in there. The people that have complaints are the people who understand that choice and use it.
So, Jerry, just one thing that came to mind. Is it possible that because most modern Android phones have larger batteries with higher capacities, that they're not reaching those stages well into their life cycle? Like within a year, 2 years, there's still enough capacity in those larger batteries that they won't need to throttle?
Maybe. It's more than just the battery size and chemistry. There's the circuitry is involved, and, you know, Apple does things one way and Android OEMs do things another way. And that could be it. There is a reason that after a year or even 2 years, your battery doesn't last as long on a charge, but it doesn't just randomly shut off when you go outside because it got so cold that the battery stopped being able to supply enough voltage, which is what was happening with the iPhone.
That sure does seem to be something that I have experienced heard from a lot of people with iPhones, but not from people with any other specific phone.
Now, I have made an Android phone shut off because it was cold and the battery stopped, but that was me playing with one in a freezer and a charger when we had this problem with you can't use the wrong charger in the wrong cable. So it can happen on an Android phone, but it doesn't normally.
So bringing it back to the Galaxy S9, I really don't I don't expect Samsung to do anything as dramatic as giving people a switch in the settings on Exynos phones that's like, use this at, you know, maximum capacity, or use it at match Snapdragon version battery life version. I don't expect that. I would simply expect that, just like every other time that they're doing an update, it could include some, you know, tweaks to the way that the software and firmware interact with the processor to, you know, maybe rein it in a little bit. But again, as we always caution people, you know, buy the phone for what it is now, not for what you expect it to change to with a software update.
One thing to remember, though, it right now, with the way Android as written by Samsung works, there's no benefit to having the power that's in the new Exynos. In fact, it's a detriment. And we can say benchmark sucks, and they do, but a benchmark that does nothing but measure how many instructions a CPU can process per second is a valid benchmark. That tells us real information. And when you're using Android and Android software, the Exynos, which we know is a lot more powerful on its high cores, big cores, Samsung calls them, it gets worse performance than the Snapdragon.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would think that Samsung's best interest would be to throttle it back, pull it down, do the same test. I forget who did it. I'm sorry. But Anantech did a test where they changed the kernel governor to match what the Snapdragon version did. And the performance and battery life were very similar. I would think that's Samsung's best move right now. Continue to work on Android software to maybe take advantage of some of this power, but don't send that out to your users.
Yeah, I think that's the right move, Jerry, and I wouldn't be surprised if that'll happen silently in a future update that'll hit Poland first and then see if it works and then go from there, as it always does. Yep. Let's shift gears a little bit and follow a story that I think is quite interesting, but Jerry thinks might not be anything. So that is an FCC filing of what looks to be an Android TV dongle. So
I'm in the Jerry camp on this one.
It's purported. So here's what we think it could be. Instead of a Chromecast dongle that gives you very little in terms of a front-end UI, nor does it give you a remote, what this looks to be is something like an Apple or a Fire TV type dongle, where you plug it in into an HDMI port and it'll give you the Android TV experience. We know that it runs an ARM processor. We know it has 2 gigs of RAM and 8 gigs of storage.
It looks shaped like the Chromecast Ultra, and that it has the little dongly part. It's not.
It's the same it's cable and HDMI connector. Yeah, it looks very similar.
And there's the one giveaway here is that part of the filing includes, or at least part of the leak includes, a remote that has a Google Assistant button on it and a Google logo on it. So whether or not this is a real Google product, it gives us an idea and a starting off point for a discussion of where we think Android TV needs to go. Android TV last year famously got an update at Google I.O. that has yet to actually launch in the real world. And Andrew, this is not because of something Google did, but because of basically the lack of distribution of both Android TV boxes and app developers that are unwilling to update their apps to support this new version.
Yeah, that new interface requires application developers to have, well, one, given enough of a care about Android TV in the first place to have an Android TV, not version, but profile or configuration of their app available. And then also they would need to integrate with this new API level that actually surfaces their content properly on Android TV. This new interface would not work at all if you did not have a large number of applications that were ready for the API level because the new interface would just show nothing, which is not ideal. And so it's kind of that chicken and the egg problem where it's kind of a double chicken and the egg problem. I don't know what you call that, but there aren't enough devices out there to make developers care. And then because developers don't care, Google can't release this new Android TV interface, but then nobody ends up caring because they don't have devices to not get updated on.
Right. And I should say this particular leak does not look like anything Google itself would ever put out. This is not a Chromecast Ultra or an app. This is definitely a licensed product for sure.
But does that really matter? Look at what Android TV think that's is the best, right? And it's
that was
going to
be my next question. Does it matter if kind of Google doesn't care about Android TV anymore as long as it continues to update the software? We know that the Nexus player is dead and that the only Android TV box in development right now is the now almost three-year-old or two and a bit year old Shield TV.
Yeah, so, but the Shield TV is fantastic. The problem is that you can't, you know, expect to conquer the Android TV or the TV box market with one product. This type of thing that we're seeing leak through the FCC that's more like a Fire TV stick or, you know, like a Roku stick or something like that is where the market is growing and I guess gravitating toward. They will not, you know, the average person will not spend $150
Bingo.
Plus on one of these boxes. That's why the original Chromecast, or I should say the second gen Chromecast, continues to be an extremely important product because it's only $30-$35. Even the Chromecast Ultra is extremely important at $69 because it's just an easy way to buy this one thing. You don't have to install anything with multiple cords. You just plug it in and that's it. So this type of product would be extremely important for Android TV, but it can't just be this product. We know it has to be way more than this. You have to have a lot of different options. And up to this point, Android TV has had, frankly, many bad options. And then later on, you know, no options.
And it's very difficult to get customers to spend $250 on an NVIDIA Shield when they can buy a Roku for $50.
Or an Xbox One for $250.
But, you know, that, to be fair, the NVIDIA Shield TV, it's so overbuilt. I'm not saying they will, but I can see the next two versions of Android being installed on it. It is.
Yeah.
It's extremely powerful and it's well worth the money, but only if you're a nerd who likes hardware. As far as having a smart TV, there are so many other options that are cheaper, including a million other Android TV devices made by Chinese manufacturers that will never get updated and were extremely underpowered and made the entire platform look like garbage.
I also want to compare the state of Chromecast, which is one of Google's, if not Google's, most successful hardware products. And Jerry argued earlier this year that it's the best hardware product Google's ever made. And I can't disagree. Just from a scale perspective, you think back to the very understated debut. When was it? Back in 2014?
It was with the Nexus 7. It was just we've got this
2013. So yeah, it's been around 5 years now and it's sold millions. Like, Google did give a number.
Yeah, it's been almost a year and a half ago, but they did give a number that was surprisingly large.
It was a giant number.
Wasn't that something like, I want to say it was like 60 million or 50 million or something like that.
So that's not a small project anymore. And Google has not only found success with the Chromecast hardware, but with the Cast protocol in general. It's so easy. So many apps support it, not just on Android, but on iOS as well. And it just works. It's one of the few things that when you tap that Cast icon, you know it's just going to work. And it's so great having it pair with the Google Home ecosystem, with a number of your favorite streaming apps, with anything that you can think of, it'll be cast supported. And this tiny HDMI dongle is what allows it to happen. Do we need an Android TV dongle? Do we need that front end? Do we need that remote when our phones are the remote, when our apps are the cast points? Do we really need the what Android TV is trying to and failing in many ways to offer?
I think some people do just, they need that remote, or they feel they need that remote, and Google's going to have to be available. Like, even honestly, it could be even something as simple as it is actually a Chromecast, but they figure out a way to have a Bluetooth remote that interacts with the Chromecast.
Microsoft could kill Android TV tomorrow. Bring back the Xbox One, cut the price in half, add Google Cast to it. And it does everything the people who think they need an Android TV would do. And I'm amazed that that's not been done yet, frankly.
But you can't underrepresent the importance that people put on the size and simplicity of plugging in a Chromecast or a little Fire TV stick.
I meant the people who think they need an Android TV box to play games and run apps and
Well, I think what we've identified is that people don't think they need an Android TV box.
Well, there's a few. I mean,
like, look at your, like, Andrew, you know, you have, I assume, a number of boxes attached to your television. Jerry, I assume the same.
I have three.
I'm out of room.
Right. You know, we have, my wife and I have an Apple TV 4K. We have a Shield TV. We have a Fire TV stick. And we have a Chromecast all attached to our receiver. And the one that gets the most use is the Apple TV by far. And it's likely because that remote, as terrible as it is easy to understand. My wife prefers it. It's not because it's better. It's certainly not a better product in any meaningful way. But this is just the product that we gravitate towards. But there are so many instances where I have to change to a Chromecast or the input to Chromecast because I don't want to bother airplaying something, which is a terrible experience. And Chromecast is always reliable. So even with that remote in front of me, there are still things that I need to do on my phone to cast to my TV.
Well, I think that Google's way to try to solve this was Assistant on built-in Android TV televisions. That way you can just say your hot word and then say play whatever, and it just plays it. And you don't need a remote. You just talk to your phone. I don't know how great that is in the long run. I don't like talking to things to make them do stuff. I would rather push a button. But I would if that's what I needed to do. I just don't know how many people there are like me out there who would rather have a button to push.
I think most people would have a button to push.
I know. I like it. I bought a $300 Logitech remote that I have a remote for everything. So
yeah. You and Phil, live and die by those Logitech Harmony remotes.
You should try one, man.
I've been tempted, but the problem is that I can only buy the best of everything. So I'd be buying the $300 Ultimate.
It's Harmony, worth it. Like,
I don't think so.
I had the $100 one at first and really loved it. So decided to try the new one on the infamous Best Buy loan. And if I don't like it, I'll take it back. And we still have it. I loved it.
It's the cognitive overload or the cognitive load of trying to force my wife to use a different remote on a daily basis. That is a hill that I just don't want to climb. Like, I cannot, yes. Well, I cannot force her to learn yet another remote and another set of commands when right now our system is working. And I just don't see the benefit. Like, there's no net benefit for me.
So here's the reality of what most people do, because I see this all the time at my parents' house. I see it at a friend's house. I see it in my own living room. People just open up their tablet or their laptop and they just watch a personal device. We will be sitting in our living room here, and my girlfriend and I will both be watching something different on a different tablet, and our TV is turned off.
That is so millennial of you.
Yeah.
But this is the thing that people do. Even if the TV is on, one person is watching on the TV, or, you know, people don't always sit down, look at the TV, go through this, you know, system of turning things on, finding the content they watch, because they were already on their laptop or their tablet or their phone or something, and that's where they came across the content that they're wanting to watch. And rather than taking the extra hurdle of sending it to a TV, which I agree, it's a very small hurdle. It's just like tapping the Chromecast button in most cases. You just watch it on, you know, your nice tablet that's got a 2K screen or whatever and good speakers, or you're wearing headphones or whatever, rather than sending it over to the TV. And so this is one of the reasons why people aren't willing to get all in, you know, most people aren't willing to get all invested in time and money and a large box and things to have that experience. They're used to the low barrier to entry of just using their own personal device as well.
I mean, I agree with you. And what ends up happening is we have an episode of something on and we're ostensibly watching it, but both of us are scrolling through Instagram at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we watch shows now. It's never our primary focus. And as sad as that sounds, it's actually no less enjoyable, because it's not like I'm missing anything in the show. It's actually, this just compounds the issue, but a lot of the shows that we're watching are shows that we've already watched before. So we kind of know what's happened. Like, this is the second time we've seen Mad Men. So we're going through the show again. So I kind of know what to expect, but it's the little like smaller details that I'm picking up on second time around.
So I think the more important thing there is that the thing that you want to watch the content on has access to the content and is super easy for you to pick up, you know, which is mostly just a thing of habit or familiarity. So those things are far more important than all these other things we're talking about with interfaces and, you know, platform decisions, things like that. It really does come down to how simple it is and whether or not it quickly gives you access to the things that you want. And right now, Android TV is not that thing.
Yeah, that's a great point, because Apple TV, Android TV, they're less connected to their ecosystems, their respective ecosystems of devices than you might think. You know, I don't care that I'm watching Netflix on my Android TV box or my Roku or my Fire TV. I just want Netflix. Long as the platform has all the apps that I require, the rest of it doesn't really matter.
Amazon has this figured out, but they don't have the content partnerships. I got my wife a nice Alexa TV. Or I'm sorry, I said that word, an Amazon TV. And she can say, you know, she can literally do what I was talking about for Amazon Video and I think Netflix, because I installed and set up what's called the video skill or something. Took just a few minutes of setup. She can just say what she wants to watch, and as long as it's on a service that's covered, it works. She can adjust the volume, and she can say skip forward, and it does exactly what you would need a remote to do, and she doesn't have to use any weird language like she's speaking to a computer. It's really good. I mean, I already said I don't like talking to stuff, but it's done really, really well. But of course, they don't have the partnerships that Apple has or even Google has. So not every piece of content can be controlled that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. It just comes down to what are your priorities? Do you need Netflix on its own, or do you need Netflix, Hulu, HBO Go, or HBO Now, and I don't know whatever else you Americans watch? But it basically just comes down to where is the easiest place for me to get my content. So I think that's why Android TV hasn't taken off, because it's not a better experience than any of the others. And there just isn't a great option other than the NVIDIA Shield, which is too expensive. Or it has been too expensive.
I mean, I might have to agree with you, even though I hate to say it's too expensive, because I love that little box. But yeah, it's $100 more expensive than even an Apple TV.
Okay, so let's move on to our final bit of follow-up here. So this is really frustrating, Jerry. So I want you to take a couple minutes to explain it. Yesterday, a company named Security Research Labs, or SRL, presented at a conference, Hack in the Box, in Amsterdam. And what two security researchers from the company did was they looked through 1,200 Android phones from the biggest OEMs, including Google, Samsung, OnePlus, ZTE, TCL, LG. And they discovered that many of these phones don't have the entirety of the of their security patches installed. And everybody went up in arms about it and was accusing, including me, accusing these companies of not caring enough about their customers. Fast forward a day, Jerry, what do we know?
Well, we don't know everything. The details that SRL has given are kind of sparse, and understandably sparse because they're using a proprietary method to do this. They didn't really check anything. They built a fuse system that stands for file system and user space, like their own little system that runs on an Android device that can work with the kernel, but it doesn't alter any of the system there. And through that bridge, they ran a set of heuristics, just like a virus scanner does. And they use that to make the decision whether or not the service updates were installed, the security patches were installed. There's three huge problems with that. Number one, they can't check any file that was written in Java. Well, if you know anything about Android, that's about 80% of Android. The second is you can't check it against the security patch update because not every phone needs every part of that.
That's so critical.
Yes. If I have, you know, I've got a Pixel phone here in my hand or whatever, I don't need the patches NVIDIA made for the GPU driver on that phone. So it's going to show that it's an incomplete patch. And then Google released a statement today to The Verge, and they don't even like, it sounds like they don't even like the way this was done, but they're going to work with these people and maybe build it out on this idea, which I think is a good thing. I love the idea.
So, I mean, this was like, if I'm reading the tone of this statement, then let me just read it for everybody quickly. It says, "We would like to thank Carsten Knoll and Jacob Kell," these are the two researchers, "for their continued efforts to reinforce the security of the Android ecosystem." That is some serious shade right there.
Yeah.
"We're working with them to improve their detection mechanisms to account for situations where a device uses an alternate security update instead of the Google-suggested security update," as you said. "Google updates, security updates rather, are one of many layers used to protect Android devices and users. Built-in platform protections such as application sandboxing and security services such as Google Play Protect are just as important. These layers of security, combined with tremendous diversity of the Android ecosystem, contribute to the researchers' conclusions that remote exploitation of Android devices remains challenging." Now, Jerry, that last point is interesting because the researchers themselves said that despite all of these oversights with patches, it's still quite hard to hack an Android phone because of all these other things that Google's done.
Yes, and you know, I'm very displeased with the way this went down, but none of that displeasure is towards Knoll and Lell. They, you know, they did what they were required to do for the company they work for, and they gave us that extra bit of input that says, you know, okay, we've said all this, but you know what? Your phone's still pretty safe, which they probably weren't required to do. So props to them. It's we have to remember that all this comes from a company that wants to sell you a product.
All and what of these, is that product?
Well, they have an app in the Play Store, and while the app is free, it collects all the system and user data that it can from your phone and sends it back. Now, granted, it needs to send a lot of that back to actually check things, but they're also going to keep it and profit from it. I've said it a million times that data is currency now. So they they stand to make a huge profit if they could get, you know, more people to install this app, which they do recommend that you install it so you can find out for yourself. My biggest problem, and it, everybody jumped without knowing the details, but that's just the nature of this industry. But the words, and I think you guys know from last night, the words lying get thrown around. There's no way in hell you were going to get me to believe that Samsung was lying to you and put a patch date of April 1 and it really wasn't complete. Samsung is not that stupid, period. Done.
So let's talk about that second sentence there where Google says, account for situations where a device uses an alternate security update instead of Google's suggested security update. So that's one thing that Jerry was talking to us about yesterday was we think of this situation where Google releases security update. It's a full blob of information that then gets sent out and then all the manufacturers just whole cloth take it and include it in their devices. But that's just not how it works. And a lot of times we've seen, you see Samsung in particular, because you just talked about them, coming up with their own fixes, their own patches for different things or parts of things that overlap or don't with Google's security patches. And in many cases, they're releasing their own separate fixes for these things independent of Google's security patches. And so if all you're doing is searching for Google's complete right. patch on a phone, you may not see it. And then you're just going to apparently assume that that phone has not been patched.
But we don't have to assume. There's Google has a list of Android certified devices, and the devices that are on that list, Samsung sends out a patch. You know, they patch their own FIPS and their own LAN drivers independently from what Google patches for Android. Google checks. And if it meets the qualifications, it gets the right patch level and everything is good to go. Google trusts it. The people who wrote the software trust it. You know, that's you can't ask for much more than that.
Right. And I'm saying that some of this analysis seems to have looked beyond that reality.
It ignored that because by design, it can't check that. So that makes me question the entire purpose of the study other than it's a marketing tool.
So most phones that claim that they have up-to-date patches are probably safe. And I think yes. The conclusion here is that if you have a phone that is receiving regular security patches, even if they don't conform 100% to Google's April 1st and April 5th, whatever, blobs, they are more secure than if they didn't have the patches them at all.
Absolutely.
I think that is a very obvious thing to say, but it needs to be said because reports like this somewhat undermine Google's strategy around releasing these monthly software updates. And it's up to us to separate the good from the BS and try to make sense of this all.
Two things really stood out to me is that this is why nerds were so excited to see Google build a separate page for Pixel updates.
Mm.
Because it tells you exactly what was needed from the Android update, plus what extra might have been needed from, you know, HTC or whoever else, a hardware vendor. And you have it listed right there. I would love to see Samsung do that for the Galaxy S and the Note. And I think it's well worth the money that would cost. Just to tame this kind of stuff down, not that most of their users care, but the users that do care have very big mouths. And then the Galaxy J3 got called out by name from this company. Throughout 2017, it said it got every single patch, but all 12 of them were lies. And that just rips me apart. Off the record, I have heard from some people that what was missing from all 12 were small, tiny components from MediaTek for the processor that weren't needed because that hardware wasn't in the J3. You know, you don't right. need to patch a MIMO 4x4 WLAN antenna if it's not there. So
why isn't it there, Jerry?
Well, I mean, I would love it to be there on a $200 phone, but I think you understand what I'm meaning, that these things that didn't get patched didn't exist. They didn't need a patch. So their system said that the phone was not patched.
So I think the other part of this is that you mentioned that's that group of people that care about the thing. There's that weird middle ground where you care about security patches, but you don't really understand the system, have gone into this mindset of the only thing that matters is getting the quote unquote Google security patch. And it's so much more difficult than that. You can't simply equate having security patch equals 100% safe, not having this security patch equals unsafe. You know, right. You can't make that equivalency. There's a lot of gray area there.
I think any regular listener of this podcast will know I'm not in love with any of the OEMs that build our phones. I have problems with all of them. And
you don't say.
It's just me being
BlackBerry.
I have a lot of problems with BlackBerry too. I just like them a little bit more. But I am completely on their side here. Building Android or any type of open source operating system means you put in a whole lot of work for the hardware that's in front of you. A lot of work. And then if you want to maintain it, it's the same amount of work. It's not like people seem to think that they can get this file from Google and just install it like an OTA at the office in Korea and then send it out to everybody. No. They get the file from Google, look at what Google did, and then rewrite all of their software the same way. And it's a lot of hard work. When they do it, I think it's awesome, and we need to, you know, congratulate them for taking the initiative. But just because it may not be exactly what you think it would be, doesn't mean that somebody's going to hack your phone. And I know I'm always on about, you know, mobile security, but even I understand that, you know, your phone could have a patch date from last year, and it's still really difficult to hack it.
Well, I'm going to try to hack this because we got to move on. And that is our first sponsor. So we are going to talk about Thrifter. Thrifter is the place to go for all of the deals that you want in your life, from smartphones to smart homes to video games to lifestyle and everything in between. That's thrifter.com. And as our producer put on the show notes this week to remind me, at Thrifter Daily on Twitter. So as we do every week, we're going to go through and each one pick a deal that we like. I'm going to put this on Andrew first because I like him. What's your deal for the week?
I like this Anker USB wall charger that has, 6 USB ports on it. I have a couple of these, and it's only $22. This is the kind of thing that instead of having a whole bunch of different USB chargers that you got to plug and unplug, these don't have, you know, they're not quick charge 3 or USB-C ports with power delivery. So you're not going to, you know, rapidly charge any of your stuff. But this is more like for maintenance to have like this thing sitting in the kitchen or, you know, at your desk or in the den or whatever, wherever you have like a desk or a counter where you're just going to toss down a lot of devices and you just need to charge them, you know, overnight or casually, or just keep them topped up. These things are perfect for that. 6 USB ports outputting a total of 60 watts. It's perfect for that.
And it could double as a space heater if you plug everything in.
Exactly. And these ones, the Anker ones, they come with a nice long cord. It's not a separate power brick. And I think they come with like a little 3M adhesive thing too, so you could stick it to a wall or stick it to a desk. Because when you have that many USB devices plugged in, it can kind of scoot around. But
these are really well-made products.
Yeah, I have one just like this that also has a USB-C port on it, but it sits on my desk.
I have one that looks like that, but doesn't have that many ports on it. And it's made by Anker. And yeah, it's good stuff.
Yep.
Then the price
$22
is
the right price.
Jerry, what's your pick?
I've been waiting for this because the product I'm going to recommend is on my head right now. You can buy a set of Hi-Fi Man HE560 planar magnetic headphones for just $350 which is about $200 cheaper than I paid for the ones on my head. I don't have time to describe what planar magnetic is. If you like driving bass, buy a pair of Beats. You won't like these. But the sound is incredibly crisp and clear. And if you've never heard a set of good electrostatic or planar magnetic headphones, you will be surprised at the way it sounds. I love them. And at this price, I almost wish that I hadn't have bought mine. I saved up for mine. And some people that comment on our site know that I was saving up for them. You know, I wish I hadn't bought them last year and could buy them now and save a couple $100. They're awesome. They're kind of open back. They're not great for on the bus or anything. And I'll tell you up front, but your phone will drive them very well.
Yeah, these look like beautiful wooden outer yep. shell, really nice weighty.
Oh, they're a little headphones. Heavy too. I do want to say that.
Good headband.
But I love them.
Beautiful.
Ignore the weird name, Hi-Fi Man. It's a Japanese name, but it's good stuff.
And that's $350 from Adorama. And these don't look like they're going to go out of stock anytime soon. So get them while they're hot. Mine is my pick is also sort of audio related. And you're actually not going to be able to get this by the time you hear it because it's an Amazon Gold deal, but I'm going to pick it anyway because I love these products. So this is the Yamaha RX V583BL receiver. That's an audio-video receiver. It is $320. Now, it probably won't be that price tomorrow, but I'm just going to use this as an opportunity to recommend Yamaha receivers. Absolutely. I have used them since I was old enough to be able to afford my own stereo equipment. So that's coming on 15 years now. The first receiver I ever bought was a Yamaha. The current one I own is a Yamaha. I've never had problems with them. They are amazing products, super reliable, really easy to set up, and they sound great. They're not the best sound. Certainly not the worst. They're very even. They're easy to tweak if you like your equalization. They have tons of HDMI outputs. HDMI inputs, and they have this one in particular supports 7.2 channel surround sound with Dolby Atmos and DTS X. It uses Yamaha's sort of proprietary music. It supports MusicCast, which is a way to create a Sonos-like experience using your own powered speakers. I'm not a huge fan of that, but it does work if you do have a bunch of them. Jerry's just going to say, buy a bunch of Chromecast audios. I will say that's probably easier. But yeah, if this is a good alternative to that. The one thing I would say is that Yamaha's Android app is like hot garbage. So don't buy it because you want to use it from your phone. But the remote's easy to use, sounds great, and it's cheap. So that's my recommendation.
If you lose the remote, one remote covers like 30 models. So it's easy to find, and you can buy a third-party one. I've got one of those here on my desk, too, that I paid $9 for, a third-party remote for my Yamaha receiver. So plus to that, too.
Yeah, these are great products. So that's my recommendation. You can find all of these deals at thrifter.com. Check them out on Twitter, at thrifterdaily. And we thank them for their sponsorship. All right, Andrew.
Yes.
I know how much you love Sony phones.
I want to love Sony phones, all right?
So yeah, I want you to love this too. So you actually haven't seen this phone yet. And I can't wait until you do. I had a chance to see it in New York, along with its larger counterpart, the Xperia XZ2. This is the XZ2 Compact. It's up for pre-order today. It's going on sale on May 6th at Best Buy. And I haven't had a chance to use the larger one for more than a few minutes, so I can't speak to that. But this is right now my favorite small phone. And I'm not saying it's, and I'm not comparing it to the Pixel 2, because the Pixel 2, it's a small-ish phone, but compared to this thing, it is not a small phone. So when I say small phone, it's kind of in its own category. So don't at me. Like, don't say, oh, the Pixel 2 is a better phone. Yes, the Pixel 2 is a better phone than this. I am not saying it's a better phone than the Pixel 2. I'm saying that if you really, really, really want a small phone and you want to be able to completely use every bit of the screen with your thumb, this is the phone to buy right now.
Boom.
I like it.
And in a world of really expensive phones, it's reasonable at $650. And you know, because it's a Sony phone, it'll be $100 off in a month.
So that's the thing, Andrew. This is not available at any US carriers. It can't be used on Verizon or Sprint. And it's not optimized for AT&T or Verizon or T-Mobile. It'll just work on those networks, but it's not like it supports voice over Wi-Fi, voice over LTE. Yeah. This is an unlocked phone through and through.
Oh my gosh, they're selling the green and the pink one in the US.
So yeah, what do you think? Like, obviously you haven't used it, but I just want to know your thoughts on kind of the small phone form factor in an age of phablets.
Well, I love it. I love that Sony still thinks that this is a market that should exist. And I mean, I was in love with the with all the compact phones, but when I used the X Compact last, I think it was the X Compact. My goodness, that's all the same. That was kind of more of a mid-rangey phone. They kind of broke from their form there by making the compact one a less enticing one. I love that this, just similarly to the Pixel 2, in that it has all of the things, but it's not gigantic. And it's not even not gigantic, it's really tightly put together. The only thing that I don't like about it is that I don't know, you can speak more to this because you actually have it, but it feels like it lost some of that Sony DNA in the hardware.
It looks like it too, yeah.
Yeah, look, this was part of
this kind of like pillowy back look. It's kind of like looks like a lozenge.
HTC 10.
Yeah, it looks like every phone. So here's the thing, right? Sony was very opinionated with its boxy designs for years and years and years, all the way going back to the first Xperia Z in 2013, right? This debuted at CES in January 2013.
Omnibalance.
It could stand up on its own, right? It could, you know, it had a completely flat bottom. And since then, they've sort of been iterating on that original design until we got to the Xperia XZ1 and XZ Premium and XZ and XZS and all these XZs and whatever. They were nice phones, but you know, as you pointed out with your XZ1 review, Andrew, they weren't anything special. These phones have eliminated as much of the bezel as possible, although they still are quite bezelicious.
And they've gone 18.9.
They've moved up to 18.9 screen. They're still LCD. And this does feel a little bit less original, but Sony has done a lot with this form factor. So I can't say that I'm going to be in love with the XZ2 because there are better, bigger phones out there. But in my opinion, there is no better small phone than the XZ2 Compact. And the battery life is amazing.
Sorry to cut you off really quickly. The XZ2 is also $800.
Yeah, so this is $150 cheaper. And you don't lose much.
So the battery life is good, even though it's a 2870 milliamp hour battery. That's great. Yes,
Sony is amazing on battery. So The one thing that I wanted to talk about with this phone is that, you know, Sony doesn't understand why it doesn't give a good reason for making phones anymore, right? It just seems like it does it just to make them, and that's the problem with their marketing, is that there's no compelling reason to buy one of these phones. What's really interesting is that I spoke to somebody in Sony a while ago, and this was an off the record conversation, so I can't really I can't identify the person, but basically the gist is that the 2016 line, so the Xperia X line, the X Performance, X Compact, that was the turning point within the company. That was the low point for Sony. Inside the company, they said, we cannot make phones like this ever again. They were poorly received. They sold poorly and nobody bought them. Nobody was interested in them. So they had to go back to the drawing board. And these are the phones now, the Xperia XZ2 series are the phones that came from that radical departure, right? It takes 18 months for a phone to go from idea to store shelves. So now we're seeing that decision from within the company in the real world.
I'm going to be screwed the next phone I buy. It's going to have to be 18 by 9, isn't it?
I hate that. This phone doesn't have a headphone jack, so.
Yeah, well, this phone isn't for me. I like the old ones, but there's nothing here to entice me, but I know that I'm different from you normal people, I guess.
So let's talk about the camera a little bit. So the camera here is the same 19-megapixel motionized sensor that was in the XZ1, XZ Premium, but Sony is now using Qualcomm's ISP to route the photos, to process the photos as opposed to using their own proprietary thing. They wouldn't say exactly what they were doing before, but now they're going all in on Qualcomm's Snapdragon 845 ISP, which is very good. And the results that I got from this phone are astounding, right? They blew me away. They are so much better than the previous generations, especially in low light.
I was horribly upset with the XZ Premium.
Yeah.
Camera.
But then the XZ1.
Well, kind of the whole phone. But
the XZ1 was good, right? Like it was a lot better.
Was it?
Sony depends on the hardware. Like they used to. I mean, they've got, is intelligent auto still on the phone with the Qualcomm ISP? Then that's got to be an awesome combination.
Andrew, you wrote an article saying that the camera on the XZ1 surprised you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about the XZ Premium still.
Oh, No.
No, the XZ1, well, I think Jerry was already getting there. It was all about how bad the intelligent auto, changing how bad the intelligent auto processing was, which is basically the whole thing. If you used the phone in manual and you actually worked for it a little bit, it could do just fine. So it sounds like Sony finally realized that as well.
Right. Oh, so I actually, as we're talking, just got an email from Sony PR correcting me. So here we go. Saying that it is Verizon compatible. So I was wrong about that.
You know what? Verizon compatible doesn't mean anything anymore.
True.
Remember, yeah. I mean, we went through this HTC U11.
If it works in 10 cities, that's now compatible.
Right. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not a home run, but I really like this phone, and I think a lot of people who want to use this phone will really like it. I think what is going to be interesting is if the XZ2, which is a little bit more premium, and it has a couple features like wireless charging and that really interesting dynamic vibration system, the Rumble Pack, if you will.
That you were just all about and want in every single phone?
I want it in every phone, yeah. And that'll be interesting.
This is the phone that made your 3D head, right?
Yeah, but nobody wants that.
Oh, I want it. I want it so bad. I want to make a video game in my spare time. No, I wanted to play with that.
I tried to build Zadie in 3D yesterday. It did not work. She just looked like a monster. But she kept moving, so it didn't work. But yeah, it's an interesting feature. Andrew, I want to move on quickly to talk about the LG G7 ThinQ. Bless you. Tell us about where we are with this device and what LG rather can do not to screw this one up.
Oh my goodness. Well, you hope that they could do that, but I don't think it's possible. But they've done they've stuck with the typical LG thing where they start to kind of pre-announce things. They went so far as to say that it will be unveiled on May 2nd, so we know that, which is cool. I'm fine with that. Their biggest issue has always been after launch, getting kind of the basics right. They're really bad at that. They're bad at pricing. They're bad at actually getting the phone out on sale in a timely manner after launch. And they're really bad at having multiple different versions around the world still and releasing special edition versions later on down the road that, well, for the most part, they just sow this feeling of buyer's remorse in the people that do choose to buy early. So they have this problem where they release the G6. They announce the G6 and then it's not on sale for like 6 weeks. And then when it comes out, it's too expensive. And then the Galaxy S8 comes out and just completely steamrolls it. And then later on down the road, they release the G6 Plus and then they make things exclusive to different areas. Those kind of issues have to be completely ironed out, or LG is just going to keep shooting itself in the foot. It's not like those problems are deal breakers in themselves, but it's more like LG doesn't have a group of people coming in clamoring for the next LG phone like Samsung and Apple do. They don't have even dedicated followers in the same way that maybe Sony or HTC does. They have this interesting middle ground where they're not really huge with the enthusiasts anymore. And at the same time, it's not as much of a mainstream followed device. So you can't mess up these basic launch things.
But that's how Samsung got where they are today, is kowtowing to carriers, a million different carrier versions that got a phone in everyone's hand.
Yeah, I agree with you. I know that that's what happened, but I think that was in a different time.
But I'm saying I can see why LG wants to keep trying. What else can they do?
I understand it. LG is in a decent position in the US simply because it does continue to play games with the carriers, but it doesn't do right by its customers. And like I said, it does have this, many of LG's releases have this air of buyer's remorse for multiple reasons. And it means that you don't get a lot of repeat customers, and it turns into issues where the G6 and the V30 were both really good phones that got completely steamrolled by the market.
Yeah, I couldn't understand why the G6 didn't sell. It was a great phone.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially after they realized that it was way overpriced and it needed to be $550. So you notice that I'm not even talking about the phone itself. I have a feeling that if the G6 and V30 are any indication, that the G7 ThinQ is going to be a fine phone. The hardware as long as LG doesn't regress in any respect with the hardware, it's going to be good. Even if it's just a refreshed V30, really. Their camera story is always good. Their software is a shortcoming, but it's fine. I'm not worried about those things. Those are not the reasons why people are not buying LG phones. I think if you just look at the G6 and the V30, right there, they're good phones that didn't sell. It wasn't because they were bad phones.
So, I mean, we always talk about the struggles of LG, but I think what does that mean these days, right? When Samsung so thoroughly dominates the market, what is, even if everything goes according to plan with this G7 launch, what is LG's strategy to get this phone to sell?
I wonder the same, because even if this sells good for them, this probably isn't enough to put them in the black.
Yeah, I'm not really saying that, you know, these are the things that LG can do, and if they do them, they'll have a success. I think it's just kind of crazy that LG is still making massive launch day, launch month, launch quarter issues. They're not eliminating any of these problems. That is still pretty crazy. And unless they can show, so it's not just the fact that they need to do these things. It's the fact that they need to show that they can do these things as part of a phone launch. And that would be a great indicator that they could get more things right as they go as well. I don't know how the heck they, make any kind of challenge for Samsung-like numbers or steal any customers away from Samsung or Apple, but it sure as heck isn't, happening the way that they're doing it now.
If everything is as we expect, the G7 will have a dedicated hardware button to activate the ThinkU assistant, which sounds familiar. I'm not sure if I can put my Bixby on it, but it does seem like that is something LG is also pursuing. The phone will inevitably continue the dual camera setup that started with the G5. With one wide angle and one ultra wide angle lens. I think what's so interesting to me, that has been the biggest differentiator of the last couple of years for the company, right? Very few companies do ultra wide angle lenses properly. Motorola has one on the X4, but it's crap. And I can't think of another company that does it.
Doesn't come to mind here.
No, yeah. I don't think. But yeah, I agree with you. It was pretty novel the way that they, it looked like a good real picture, not a messy thing with a good spot in the center. So I have to agree with you.
So the question there is, do you feel like LG just isn't, they don't have enough of those types of situations where they clearly do something different than everybody else, and it's good to be able to leverage them and market them completely?
I don't know. So LG is...
What other things can you point to and say LG does this differently and or better than Samsung?
LG is far more forward-thinking than any other company except the old Motorola. They do things...
But in what examples in their last... Just for G6 and V30, for example.
Well... They stopped. The V10 was extremely different from anything we'd ever seen. The G5
sure,
with modules.
Okay, yeah.
The way, their Optimus line, the way they built the phones and the materials they used, these are things that every company does now, but LG did them first. And they don't get any credit for that. It's LG can't do anything right because no matter what they do, there is an army of people to demean it.
Well, and I mean, there's also the problem that a lot of those things came with big downsides,
sure,
or they weren't executed well. I mean, there is that. I completely agree that they had a lot of great ideas and they did a lot of really cool things with phones, but that has not translated into success in the long run. And they've turned into creating phones that are the same as other companies' phones and not as good or well-received.
Yeah. Samsung does a lot of forward-thinking things too, but they get a second chance to make it really good. And for one reason or another, LG seems to have never gotten that second chance, except with the V series.
So here's something that came to mind, Jerry. What are the chances now that Google has these 2,000 HTC engineers that LG will be a part of the Pixel program this year?
I don't know, man. They've got a bunch of HTC engineers, but Google still needs to buy a display from somebody. LG's still going to be better at delivering, a mobile system on chip and baseband setup that actually works, because Google may have the engineers, but they still need to find somebody to build it for them, somebody to debug it for them. They don't have a factory. I still think that LG is not out of the picture completely. I'm not going to say we'll see a separate phone made by LG, but it would not surprise me to see the phone manufactured by LG.
Yeah, it does seem likely that LG will once again be involved. Google has always had a very close relationship with LG. So, I know that there were... When we were in Barcelona, Andrew, I remember part of the pitch for the V30S ThinkU, or the V30S Plus ThinkU, name, was in addition to the AI implementation, extra Google Assistant
actions that you could take using this phone. Google and LG have worked quite closely on marrying some Google software to LG's, you know, particular hardware. And I don't think that's going anywhere because...
No, I hope not.
That's an interesting idea. But yeah, I can't say whether that translates into sales. At the same time, LG is still the third largest OEM in the US. So,
but is number three making any money?
No, they're not.
That's all. Yeah, that's I think the root of the problem. And I know I felt the same way for HTC for years. I hate to see this happen to a company that does so much good stuff.
We'll see. We're going to take a second quick break to thank our sponsor, GameStash. GameStash is the place to go for all your weekly deals. No, I'm kidding. Again, it is the place to go for your gaming addiction. If you're on Android and you like to play games, for $5 a month, you can play all the games you want, hundreds of them, for a low monthly cost. And if you sign up right now at GameStash.com/ACPod, you can get a full 30 days for free, no obligation. You can cancel at any time. Your credit card will not be charged. GameStash makes premium games as part of its package. You can play games that cost $5, $10, they're included. And any free-to-play games that you are annoyed at because they had ads or they had loot boxes or any other in-app purchases you didn't want to pay for, those are all now free. GameStash works with developers to optimize the games for the subscription service, and they are better for it. If you're interested, head to GameStash.com/ACPod, sign up for your free 30-day trial, and tell them AC sent you. All right, the last topic of the day is kind of cool. It's a Gmail overhaul, a redesign that we've been waiting a long time for, Andrew.
This looks good.
What do we know about this redesign so far?
So it's kind of a weird thing. Google sent out an email to administrators of paid G Suite accounts saying, by the way, the interface for Gmail is going to change for personal accounts, and then you're going to have the option to enable it in your console so people in your organization can have it. And of course, so we realized, oh, that means that there's a redesign coming to Gmail. And then The Verge picked up a few different leaked screenshots of it, and it looks a lot like this new Google Calendar redesign that we got, what was that, a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, on the web, at least. We're just talking about the web here. The biggest thing is not the... sure, they changed the look of some icons, and they kind of softened and round everything, of course. But the big change is you have this new little bar on the side that lets you quickly launch... I wouldn't call it launch, but display at the same time Google Calendar, Google Keep, or To-Dos, or whatever, in a little sidebar in the side of Gmail, which is awesome.
We used to have, and everybody hated, and they took it away.
Well, and you've always had this kind of Gmail integration thing, with Google Calendar, where if you went to add an event that was auto kind of generated from the email, that it would say whether or not you had something that collided with it on the calendar. There's always been that kind of there.
I mean,
this is its own separate.
We literally had these, well, we didn't have Keep back then. You just went into the settings and enabled them. You could put Hangouts there too, or Google Talk. This is something they already tried and failed at. I guess they think they can do better this time.
Oh, this just looks... This is not a stupid month calendar widget in the bottom left corner. I think it's all about the implementation of it being a full interactive calendar window, if you will, just in a pane on the right side of the inbox. So you basically say, I'm looking at my email. It kind of actually looks a little bit like it's... as if it were using the Fragments API in Android.
Well, you're getting there. I'm trying to lead you.
the multiple interface panes where you can kind of slide in from one side and you can open it up on the side.
I am going to guess, and this is where I was heading, why it failed last time because it was just a calendar. Something tells me this time, if you open an email that has an event or anything that may tie into your calendar, it's going to display the information about that day on the side because Google has that capability. And you're right, it's kind of like an intent system for the web. And if they do that, that is awesome.
So how does this translate eventually to the Android version or the mobile versions? Because, you know, we know that inbox is a thing, right? Smart replies on inbox and on the Gmail app right now are a thing. How does Gmail for Android get better if it can?
Well, I think maybe you leave this stuff out, build the inbox stuff in that's good, like the snooze and maybe the sorting people seem to think it's better. But you don't add widgets and sidebars and all this other stuff for an application that 99% of the people are using on a phone, a small screen device, not a tablet. So
yeah, that's the biggest problem. It's really easy to integrate. So some of the newer thing, the other new features here are snoozing and sorting and reminders about specific things that people like in third-party email clients and like in inbox. Those things are obviously really easy to implement behind just a swipe function or an overflow button or something in Android. How well you could do, I mean, the big thing is, I don't think you could do the multiple application thing well, especially on a phone. That really doesn't feel like that's a core change to Gmail as a service. That's a core change to Gmail interface on the web. Just in the same way that right now you have the little Google application launcher in the top right corner of your Gmail interface on the web, and you can click that and quickly open Google Drive in another window or another tab. That has nothing to do with Gmail as a service. It's just something that you get when you have the larger screen.
Right.
And so I hope that Google doesn't try to do something complicated like that in the Gmail app, because frankly, the Gmail app is a little bit on the confusing side.
Starting
like
to get
Jerry
there.
Said,
yeah.
it does a lot of things that people don't bother with. And a lot of times I would just like it to be even simpler.
Agreed. I think it's getting too much.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about email on phones. I use Newton, which is very, very, very simple. And that's its biggest strength, is there's not a whole lot you can do because a lot of the smarts are in the background. It uses AI to filter my apps that I, or emails that I want to see in my focus inbox, and everything else goes into sort of a couple of folders. One's social emails and the other are subscriptions. And you can teach it if you want, but I generally just trust it. And I've started, because we use Slack at AC and the rest of Mobile Nations, I use email more for like triage, right? I get a lot of email and I try to respond as quickly as I can to the ones that matter. And the other ones I don't touch, I just ignore. So how can email on mobile, how can Gmail improve? It seems like we've kind of reached a point where email in general is in this, it's mature. It doesn't need to get much better or different.
I think
that
Google's future will be, there is no more email or Allo or Signal or Hangouts or anything else. There's one app. And they tried it with Hangouts once before. You want to send a message to someone, you just type. And the app knows if they're online, it sends it as an instant message. If they're not online, it sends it as an email. Or if they prefer voice calls, it sends it as a voicemail. I really think that's where Google's headed. That's what they would like to see. I don't know if I'd like it, but I don't have a say in it.
I think that the important thing is that most average people, this is kind of like the TV discussion, most average people don't manage their inbox, or, well, they don't receive the stupid amounts of email that we receive, but they don't, I mean, unless they have a job which depends on a work email account, which in many ways, in many cases, that's something that is either not on their phone or is, you know, completely separated to a different application from their personal email. They're not really thinking about email in the same way that you might say an internet power user or a power user of the internet, whatever Mark Zuckerberg is, would do with the email on their phone.
He would sell it and to someone else.
I think that, well, he had that statement. He was like, I'm a power user of the internet, so I know what's going on here. Gmail right now feels like it is a power user tool that tries to, a Gmail app on Android that tries to replicate a full Gmail experience in a little window that can't do all that stuff very well. And people don't really expect it to do all that stuff. And so that's why you see things like inbox. Now the question is, does inbox go away when all of its features get duplicated back into the Gmail interface?
Depends on how the UI looks for Gmail. If they can,
or I guess does it stop improving? Rather,
if they can take Gmail and make it look simple, even if it's still doing all this crazy stuff on the back end, but the things you're not worried about just kind of disappear and it's more like an inbox app, then there's no need to have two apps. I just don't know if they can integrate that, you know, or if it's even worthwhile to do it. Or, you know, who's to say they're not going to go the extra step and build something like Newton for Daniel that just does it? We are Google, trust us. And people would use it, and a lot of people would love it.
I agree. I think a lot of what makes email bad today is that there's no intervention other than spam filtering. Right. There's not enough intervention on the part of the platform to give us a better experience. We expect AI intervention in every other part of our waking life, and email is still quite dumb. And I think, I don't know, personally, I enjoy the parts. I enjoy email only when I know that there's something working to make it a simpler and better experience for me. That's why inbox is so good. I think, you know, Gmail could use a splash of that, but yeah, I don't know if it needs a complete overhaul.
I need to give in and do what you're doing. That's
I don't do that either.
I have fought all day to make sure if I get one more email, my inbox has over 6,000 unread messages in it, and that there's no way I'll ever be able to reply to them. I just can't let go. And I try to reply to every single email I get that Google doesn't say is spam. But I can't do it. There's no way I can do it. But every time I've tried to let go, I tried inbox. I tried another client on my MacBook that more intelligent filtering. Don't think it was Newton. I ended up not trusting it. And it was probably my fault. But I have to do it, Daniel. Teach
you
me.
Do. Just let yourself go, man.
You know what?
Just crack, I need to open go in a here, beer and just need, sign up for Newton.
I need to go in here and archive all and then go get Newton, don't I?
Yeah, man. Go get nude and then go get Newton. You'll feel so much better.
Okay.
And I think that's the biggest thing here. None of these changes that are forthcoming to Gmail that I think they do look nice. They modernize the interface of Gmail, make it slightly more useful. But it is still the exact same email Gmail paradigm. You know, you still see inbox, starred, sent, drafts, and a little more caret where you can have your folders and your labels and things.
You almost have to.
You still have the same interface. You're right. This is a cleaner, better looking Gmail, but it is not Newton or any of these other apps that take a more heavy-handed approach to managing your email for you. Now, for me, I'm okay with that. I use the Gmail interface on the web straight up. I use a couple different categories in terms of, like, I use the priority. I use unread, starred, everything else. I use folders and labels. I'm extremely OCD just as a person in general, and so I handle that. But normal people don't do that. They I think while they don't have to manage the pile of email that we do, but they also, even for their respectively small pile, they don't want to do any management of it or use email like that. And Gmail kind of feels like it's not addressing those people.
Honestly, I cannot recommend. And if you don't want to pay for it, because Newton's a paid subscription, just try Outlook. Honestly, just the difference between a focus inbox and a non-focus inbox, and just trusting that you, I mean, every once in a while, yeah, you should check your other inbox to make sure that nothing passed, nothing got caught. But I rarely have any problems, and I really, it just takes some stress off my shoulders and makes me feel better about email in general. So yeah, I try it. All right, guys. So that's an hour and a half of delicious AC podcast. And I think we're going to leave it there for this week. Andrew, Jerry, thank you so much. You two are lovely, wonderful people. And I don't think I actually complimented Alex last week. I think in that awkward introduction, I didn't say he was a lovely, awesome person. So Alex, if you're listening, if you got this far, don't tell him. Just let him, let's see if he actually listens to the podcast.
Yes. Everybody tweet Alex. Everybody. No, all of you.
Don't at him.
No, definitely at him. He needs it.
They did me last week. And thank you guys. I did read them all. I stopped replying after the first bunch. But thank you. It does make me feel better to see not everybody's with butthead.
There you go. Love you, Jerry. Love you, Andrew. Love you, listeners. Thank you so, so much. Even the ones who sent me constructive and reasonable emails after the show last week. I always appreciate it. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Adios.
Bye.